Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're meeting with Freedom Forum of Orange County. This is Wednesday, December 5th. And I want to welcome you all here. This is a tremendous crowd. Thank you all for being here. Tonight, we're honored to have... We're honored to have Bill Thornton with us. He is presenting tonight Challenging Jurisdiction of Habeas Corpus. And I will read this a little bit better for you. First of all, a little bit about Bill. I've known him now for about, eight years, I think, or so. Longer than that. And he has been a very powerful influence for me. Judy and I often met and spoke of various activities. He's made presentations here before. Anyway, he's been, for the past 40 years, involved with the Nitty Gritty Law Library. That's the name of his site, and that his nom de plume, so to speak, where he's provided free legal research for anybody who was interested and needed help in the various areas of their particular issues, with the things like the homes and the courts and so on. It was originally known as Sovereign's Paradise. The word sovereign is unfortunately bantied about, not in a positive way, by a lot of groups. Anyway, it delivered information about personal sovereignty and law through a bulletin board system, at that time using Opus software. We have 1215.org is now his site. That's the one where he has a lot of information. I would highly recommend you all, if you haven't been there yet, look it up and see the things that he's got to offer. It's there for the use. That's what his intentions are. As far as the subject matter here, it's often the judges will take abusive advantage of one's ignorance. Even though they know they do not have genuine jurisdiction, habeas corpus is the red tape cutter. It efficiently goes directly to the jurisdiction issue. The nitty-gritty law library speaker will present the history of habeas corpus and how it can be used to challenge an unlawful taking of jurisdiction. Each attendee will receive a free disc, which if you haven't gotten it yet, I have them here. Make sure you see me after the program tonight to get your copy if you haven't already done so. It's 130 megabytes of case law, practical instructions, and other legal writings related to habeas corpus. Anyway, as I mentioned, go to the webpage, 1215.org, and you will find a lot of information pertaining to this and a number of other subjects as well. At this time, without any ado, I'd like to present to you Bill Thornton.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. I think we're about there.
How'd you like the build? Not bad, huh?
What I'm starting off with here is the website, 1215.org. As soon as it comes up, I'll start talking about it. Actually, before I start talking about habeas corpus, I'm going to talk briefly about the website 1215.org, because you kind of need to understand some of the things that are on that website before you can appreciate what habeas corpus is all about. Okay? Now, let's see. That's the disk. This is the website. Okay, this is 1215.org. What you will see on the website is some big letters that say start here. It doesn't show on this screen, but it says start here. And that if you're not familiar with the website, please click on start here. Okay, you'll get some instructions as how to learn this material. This is basically what you will see. I'm going to have to reduce the size here a little bit. There you are. This is basically what you're going to see on the screen when you get there. Basically, there's an overview. You also have on the website, you have a four-hour summary of what the website's all about, just giving you a general encapsulated kind of thing. What's the time I have? 2 hours? Yeah. Okay, we're going to have a two-hour presentation here. Notify me on 1 hour. Okay. So there's the first thing is the foundation. Okay. Now here you have a set of instructions. If you're new to the site, it tells you what to do. And basically what it's telling you is to go through all these links that you see at the bottom and one at a time read the web page that pops up and then return to this page. Don't chase the links. In other words, you'll see further links and more, you'll be forever. But instead, just go the first level of the links, because this will give you a basic understanding of what it's all about. Okay, the first thing I want to tell you about is that you got to have an attitude, a good attitude. If you are angry or if you're always happy, either way, it won't work for you. Okay? If you have strong emotions, you block off your mind and you won't see the opportunities to win. I divide most of the people that call me for help into two classes. They're either fighters or they're winners. Okay? The winners will do what's necessary to win. The fighters will turn down an opportunity to win and continue the fight. And believe me, they do it. They won't take the winning option. They'll say, well, what about this? What about this? And they go down these little legal alleyways and they never stay on the main course and they don't win. So I encourage you to be a winner and keep your mind open to the possibilities for winning instead of the possibilities for fighting. Okay? So attitude is extremely important. Just to show you how attitude affects you, I assume everybody at some time or another made a new purchase of a car. Might have been a used car, but you still bought a car. How many times have you bought a car and then noticed that everybody else was driving the same model car on the street? You never noticed them before. Okay? At least that's happened to me. Well, attitude tends to channel your mind. So you don't want to have a channeled mind. You want to be open to the possibilities. Keep open-minded. Don't do like my dad said when I was arguing with him one time. He said it in fun, but he said, an open mind is an empty mind. Okay? In this case, you want to fill your mind with the possibilities. Second thing that's important is language and dictionaries. What language are you speaking? In America, we speak three languages, and all three languages are called English. The low-level language is called slang. That varies from block to block, from day to day. There's no telling what a word might mean 3 days from now. The second language that we speak called English is actually business English, or sometimes called formal English. And this is the language that you use when you're communicating with strangers. Then there's the King English or Court English. This is the language that's spoken in the courtroom. And believe me, don't try to use business English in court because you will get trapped. Okay? A perfect example of that is the word resonant. Okay? We use the word resonant loosely because, frankly, we're taught that in school. Are you a resident of California? Most people say, well, yeah. You know, I live here, I work here. Sure, I'm a resident. Well, what does resonant mean? Well, the most common example that I know of where the word resident is used properly is when we talk about a doctor doing his residency in a hospital. Okay? Blast you. Okay. A doctor goes through the university, he gets his MD degree, but just because he has an MD degree, he's still not allowed to practice medicine. What does he have to do? He has to do his residency in a hospital. What that means is he goes to the hospital and temporarily works there, and upon completion of the program, he will leave. So the legal meaning of the word resident is a temporary place where you work. Okay? The proper word, which is not really taught in school, is domiciled. If you are domiciled, that means you belong here. If you are resident, then you have to have a reason for being here. Okay? And the reason typically is, well, that's you're working. You've got a project or an objective, and once you accomplish it, you're going to leave. Why do they teach resident instead of school, instead of domicile? Because the Constitution of the United States says that Congress has the authority to regulate interstate commerce. Well, resident means you came from outside the jurisdiction into the jurisdiction. If you came from outside of the jurisdiction into California, that means you're a resident of California. You've got your purpose, and you will go home. And where is home? Well, if you're a citizen of the United States, home is Washington, D.C. Okay? So now, because you are a resident, the federal government has the authority to regulate you. That's why you have to have a driver's license, business license, marriage license, and so forth. Okay? So you have to be careful about the language. Now, what I did to educate myself in language is I took the Constitution to at the public library, and I assumed I did not know how to speak court English. Okay? Just made the assumption. It's a separate language. There's a set of books that you will find in the libraries. I think most of the libraries now have them stored in the basement somewhere. But it was called Words and Phrases. And I looked up each word, no matter how simple it was. The word to, spelled T-O, has about, I think, as I recall, 4 or 5 pages of court cites where people battled over the meaning of the word to. So every word has specific meaning in the courtroom. And these meanings are durable. They last for hundreds of years. So you've got to know how to speak court English. Don't assume just because you see a word, you know what it means. As long as I'm on the subject, let me warn you about the word duly. I see people use that word left and right all the time. They say somebody was duly notified. Let me tell you what duly means. Duly means that whatever it is that was duly done satisfies the requirements of both the equity and the common law. If that's what you mean, it's okay to use it. But most people that use it don't even know what it means, but it sure sounds good. Okay? Don't use a word because it sounds good. All right. People or citizen, which one are you? Well, let me tell you something. The Constitution says the people, we the people of the United States, in order to accomplish this laundry list of tasks, do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Well, notice that. It says, we the people. Now, I don't know who the people are, but I know where they're from. They're from the United States. We the people of the United States. And I don't, in addition to not knowing who they are, I do know their relationship between them and the United States of America, because we, the people, ordained and established this Constitution for them. So we are the creators of them, okay? We ordained and created this Constitution for the United States of America. Notice that. We came from the United States, and we created this for the United States of America. Two words and four words. Okay? The United States of America is not the same as the United States. Two different entities. The United States is the states that are united. The United States of America is a public trust. If you look at the preamble has all the elements of a trust. It has a trustor, trustee, beneficiary, has a list of duties, and so it has the authority. It says we ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States. Well, ordain and establish. Ordain means we made the law. We authorized it. And establish means we wrote it on the parchment. Okay? That's what ordain and establish means. So we, the people, are the creators. I'm not saying we are sovereign. What I'm saying is we are sovereign relative to the United States or the United States of America. This is the basis. When I go into a court, when a judge issues an order, I issue an order removing it. Why? Because I'm the higher authority. I'm one of the people. Never say you're a citizen. Okay? We say people versus citizen. Okay? People or citizen, which one are you? If you're a citizen of the United States, then you're under the 14th Amendment. Now, the word citizen is context sensitive. In other words, what it means depends on how it's being used. So the word citizen could mean that you are sovereign, but it could also mean that you're a slave. Okay? When they created the 14th Amendment, they freed all the slaves. What did they free them from? They freed them from private ownership. Now, they transferred all those slaves out of private ownership into public ownership. Because the 14th Amendment says that if you are born or naturalized, either way, and subject to the jurisdiction, then you are a citizen of the United States. So if you're not subject to this jurisdiction, even if you're born here or naturalized, that does not mean that you are a citizen. Okay? You could be one of the people. So in your legal paperwork, because there is confusion on the word citizen and ease of misinterpretation, never use the word citizen for yourself. Always, if you're going to make a claim about yourself, claim that you are one of the people. Okay? Because after all, it's what the Constitution says. All right, so next thing is sovereignty. What is sovereignty? Well, it's pretty simple. Sovereignty means not accountable to higher authority. Okay? Well, we the people created this outfit. Should we be accountable to our own creation? I don't think so. No? You can if you want to. Just to illustrate the example, if you've ever heard of Roman's Bookstores. Roman's Bookstores is a bookstore in Pasadena. I don't know if they're still in business or not, but they were there. And there was this one guy that I knew, and I noticed that the manager was always pussyfooting around this guy. You know? I mean, my sense of it was there was not this normal employer-employee relationship. But what it turned out is that the employee was actually the owner, but he decided that he didn't want to mess with the business and he just wanted a little clerical job. Okay? So, as the owner, he could step in any time and redefine the duties of the manager. So that's why the manager was kind of careful with him. All right? Well, it's the same thing with the government. We own the government. And we as a people are sovereign. By the way, the word people can be singular or plural. All right? The word person is singular. The plural of person is persons with an S. Okay? The word people is either plural or singular, depending on the context in which it's used, but it's the same word. So you don't use the word people when you mean the plural of person. Okay? Anyhow, so if you choose, you can be a citizen for some purposes and not a citizen for other purposes. So I think many of you may have heard of the Aurora case. Okay? Here's a lady who had four felonies put against her, and she did a counterclaim. She had prior service in the military. She had been a foreigner who was naturalized. She was Filipino. She had a driver's license. She had a Social Security number. That didn't stop her from asserting her sovereignty. When she did her counterclaim, she adopted her sovereign position. Never challenged, not on that basis. So you can be a citizen for some purposes, not a citizen for other purposes. Okay. Another thing about sovereignty, by the way, what I just said is this Supreme Court's decision. Okay? Not accountable to higher authority. That's a Supreme Court decision. Another Supreme Court decision says that the decree of the sovereign is what makes law. When I put together a law case, I always have a section called law of the case. And there, I put in a little phrase, I say, the law of the case is decreed as follows. And then I list all the things that I want law. The way that I fool the opposition is I will lift the wording out of some code, put it in there. I'll put a reference showing what code section I got it from. But the thing that they don't understand, but I do, is that I got the wording from them, but the authority comes from me. That law does not exist until I say so. I'm the sovereign of this court, and I decree what the law is, and the law will be used for this case. Okay? By the way, I'm also the plaintiff. So keep that in mind. I'll get into that a little later. All right. It's important to understand the difference between a republic and a democracy. You'll notice in the Pledge of Allegiance of the United States, it says here, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It's a republic. What is the difference between a republic and a democracy? You notice all the politicians say democracy? Well, it is a democracy from the standpoint of the citizens, but it's not a democracy. It's actually a republic from the standpoint of the people. Here's what a republic is and a democracy. The best way to explain it is to explain a democracy first. A democracy is very simply defined. 51 beats 49. Okay? The beauty of a democracy is that 49% don't have any rights, and the 51% don't need rights. Okay? What the 51 say beats the 49. So you have this group here that argues among itself what's going on, and then finally they put it to a vote, and whatever the group says, that is now law. It's mandatory upon the members of the group. The important thing to understand about a democracy is that the sovereignty is in the group. The individuals have no sovereignty. Now contrast that with a republic. A republic is identical to a democracy. There is no difference between a republic and a democracy except on one very critical point. And that is that the sovereignty is in each individual person. Now you remember that sovereign, the word sovereign means not accountable to higher authority. Okay? So, the people in a republic argue among themselves. Then they vote. The group says, this is what we should do. However, the individuals are sovereign. That means they're not accountable to higher authority. At the very best, whatever decision the group makes, it can only be advisory. It cannot be obligatory. Because why? The individuals are not accountable to the group. Okay? So That is what makes the difference between a republic and a democracy. A democracy leads to a dictatorship of the majority. A republic leads to freedom. Okay? Why? Because what the group says is only advisory. If an individual says, well, I really don't agree with this, he don't have to go along. Now, the United States is a clipped republic. That means it's not 100% republic. What makes the difference is this. You know, in a jury trial, criminal jury trial, it takes all 12 jurors to make a conviction. You see, each juror, in theory, statistically represents 1/12 of all of society. If one juror says not guilty, that means that 1/12 of all the members of the group don't agree. They have their own opinion. And we respect that in a republic. So when 100% of the jury is against you, that represents 100% of society, and at that point we operate like a democracy. So you lose your sovereignty when you have 100% of the jury against you. Speaking of juries, here in the United States, we have two kinds of juries. We have fully empowered juries, and then we have advisory juries. Now, the only place where a fully empowered jury will appear is in a court of law. Okay? All the courts that you see operating today are courts in equity. I'll explain the difference in a moment. But they're all courts in equity. When you're talking about equity, well, let me explain. A court, a law court, operates according to law. In olden days, if there was no law to cover a situation, you could petition the king for a new law to cover whatever the special situation is that wasn't covered before. The king, being a busy man, would delegate the decision to his chancellor. The chancellor was the equivalent of a judge, but in the equity court. So in the law court, he's called a judge. In an equity court, he's called a chancellor. The chancellor was the king's right-hand man. If the king is not present, the chancellor will do exactly what the king is. He'll make up a law on the spot. The chancellor can suspend the law if necessary. Okay? Suspend the rules. He's free to do whatever he wants. So if you go to court and you get a strange decision from the chancellor, who is mistakenly called a judge in the American court system, he has that authority. Okay? He has discretion. Now, what you want is a law court. You don't want an equity court if you really want justice. Okay? Otherwise, you're subject to the opinions or the discretion or the indiscretion of the judge. Okay? And if the indiscretion is bad enough, sure, you can correct it in the appellate court, but 99% of all the cases appealed get nowhere. Okay, well, anyhow, so republic versus democracy, that's the importance, is the fact that you can claim you're one of the people, and that's a claim of right. It's not a claim of privilege. Okay? California and all the states are republics. They like to say, well, in Louisiana, they're under
Napoleonic
law. Thank you. So, well, in a sense, that's true. On the other hand, it must be a republic. And if it's a republic, you're sovereign. And if it's sovereign, you can do what sovereigns do. One of the things that sovereigns do is they make their own courts. So, what is common law? Well, I think you should realize that there are two common laws and two equity laws. Okay? I suspect the confusion is intentional. Basically, let's go back to the people. The people who, back in the early days, maybe 400 or 500 years ago, or 800 years ago, actually, in the day that the Magna Carta was created, the people basically were the nobility, and then there was the king. Well, the king was conducting his own private wars. He was forcing the nobility to provide the soldiers and to provide the funding and this sort of thing. So they finally self-organized, and they got tired of this garbage,
And they cornered King John by the Thames River at Runnymede, and they made him an offer that he couldn't refuse. They said, sign this Magna Carta and we won't cut your head off. So he signed. Then later, they got the Pope to bless it. Neither the king nor the Pope had any intent of letting this ride. But they were kind of stuck for it for the moment because the nobility was well organized. As Providence would have it, both the king and the Pope died within a year and a half of that event. And the new king and the new Pope, both of those guys, did not have their hooks into their organization yet. They were not well organized. The nobility were still organized, and they went back and they got these guys to recertify the Magna Carta. Every kingship since then has recertified the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta has been modified, but not deleted, meaning that certain provisions of the Magna Carta were removed from the Magna Carta and placed in a different part of the law of England or of Great Britain. But they're still there. It's just that they got relocated. You can still cite the original Magna Carta because although the provisions got moved to other places, they're still valid. And I was looking at the American Bar Association's book. Can't remember the title of the book, but I came across some interesting stuff in there. And one of the things I came across was the Confirmatio Cartarum, which recertifies the Magna Carta. And I'll get to that in just a moment. Okay, the common law basically was the law of the people put in place by force. And the evidence of that is the Magna Carta. So basically what the Magna Carta says is that the people are supreme, okay? And you'll see that in Article 61. It talks about the grand jury, okay? So the people can, if they're not happy with the king, or let's put it this way, if somebody is not happy with the king, he can go and complain to the grand jury. The grand jury, four members of the grand jury can go to the king and they say, you've got 40 days to fix this problem. If the king doesn't fix the problem, the grand jury can, they go back, report to the grand jury. The grand jury now has complete authority to do anything to the king except kill him. They can't kill the king and they can't kill his family. Okay? But they can strip him of his properties and everything else. And in the Confirmatio Cartarum, meaning the confirming charter, it says right there that everybody is authorized to support, legally authorized to support that grand jury, okay? And once the issues get settled, that's supposed to be the end of it. They're not supposed to hold a grudge. That's the theory anyway. Anyway, so that is your common law. It's basically the general opinion of the people. That common law, that concept shows up in the Seventh Amendment of our Constitution, because in the Seventh Amendment it says that in any case at law, that that the decision of a jury is not appealable in any court other than by the rules of the common law. And what's the rule of the common law? Well, you have to have a new trial with a new jury. Okay. If you look at the concept on paper, theoretically you could have a trial. Somebody objects, you could have a new trial. Somebody objects, you could have a new trial go on forever. In actual practice, I read someplace that they have something like maybe two or three trials that went the third time in a century. It's a concept that works. And I think the reason it works is because if you try to have another trial with the same fact, you're going to get convicted again. So what's the point? Anyway, that's the basic common law. Now you come over to the equity law, and for purposes of this local discussion, I refer to the common law with a capital C, and I refer to the equity law with a capital E, okay? So the equity law is now the law of the king, okay? He's the one that administers things and varies it, whatever he wants to do. So that's the equity law. Now, the king himself created two branches of law, one which he called common law, and the other one he called equity law. Well, the common law there is written, because somebody goes to the common law court of the king, which I spell with a lowercase c, and if he can't get satisfaction there, or rather, if he can't find a law that applies to his situation, he can go to the king. The king can direct him to go to the equity court, and so the equity court with a lowercase e has no rules to go by. It instead is like the original common law in the sense that it's whatever the discretion of the judge is, okay? Or I should say the chancellor. So that bit of confusion really throws the attorneys off course. First of all, they're not taught common law when they go to school. All they're taught basically is statutes, codes, rules, regulations, and case law. That pretty well sums up what they get taught. They don't know anything about Magna Carta. They go through 3 years of law school, and then the fourth year they study the Constitution. Basically, law school is a systems design school. They're learning to study the legal system. Okay? If you do a system study on any system, you always start with the top documents, the concepts, the principles, and you drill down into the detail. When students go to law school, they start with the detail and they go up into the principles. And by that time, they have irrevocable ideas as to how what the concepts are. It's so bad that when an attorney starts practicing, the Supreme Court of California will not let an attorney in the doors if he has less than 5 years experience. Okay? Because they don't know what they're doing. They're just out of law school. Anyway, all right. What is a court? Very simple. There's two definitions, okay? There the let's see if I've got it here. Here it is. Let's see if I can bring this up here. Okay. It is the person and the suit of the sovereign, the place where the sovereign sojourns with his legal retinue, wherever that may be. So, here in the United States, the people are sovereign. You see, when we broke away from England, we created the Declaration of Independence, where we dumped off England. At the same time, King John revoked all the charters of the organizations here. So technically, there was no law of the king in the United States or in the colonies. So we operated under the common law. People were very well educated here in the United States, or I should say the colonies at that time. In fact, they were so well educated that an admiral wrote back to the king before the Declaration of Independence complaining to the king that he could not enforce the king's edicts because everybody in the United States was a lawyer. They sold more law books out of England to the United States than they sold in England itself. So we were very, very conscious. We had an excellent educational system. Just to show you how excellent it was, everybody heard of Harvard University? Did you know that Harvard University was over 100 years old in 1776? Okay? We had a perfectly operating system that did not depend on government. And it was a good system. There have been politicians who went out campaigning and thought the farmers were, you know, ignorant or whatever, and discovered that these people were very knowledgeable about law and rights and so forth. So anyway, a court is the person and suit of the sovereign. Now here it has the word suite, okay? What a court comes from is this. You have a king sitting on the throne. And if you consider this, it'll be easier to understand how our courts operate and what they are. The king sitting on his throne, and out in front of him are all the courtiers, all the people who gravitate to the center of power. Okay? And so at that time, the only people who could read or write were the priests. Okay? The ordinary person, even nobility, didn't know how to read or write. The king, his specialty was grabbing a sword. He was the best swordsman. So the king sat there, and he made all the decisions. He's the one who, quote, sued whoever he felt misbehaved. So the king, because there was no reading and writing in the beginning, he relied upon the courtiers, that suite of people. Remember, suite is a collection, right? So he relied on that suite of people for the court memory. If the king forgot, he could always ask one of the courtiers, well, what do you think, or what do you remember? And that was the court record. So eventually, the suite became suit. So it is, if you look in later dictionaries, it'll say the person and suit of the sovereign. Okay? So when the king sues, and you are in your sovereign capacity, you are the king when you are the plaintiff suing somebody. And by the way, you are the owner of the court. Okay? Just like you would be the owner of the business. The judge is merely the top officer of the court, or in other words, the manager of your business, but you're the owner. That's why you outrank the judge, and that's why you have the authority to remove a judgment or decision by the judge, unless you give him permission to make the decision, which I don't normally. Anyhow, that's under international law, the person and suite of the sovereign, the place where the sovereign sojourns with his regal retinue. Remember, if you go in anywhere, your court travels with you. Okay? Sometimes there will be a case, and somebody will counterclaim on it. So he's opened up his own court, and he's named the other court as a defendant. Well, if the other court decides to proceed and do anything, when the defendant shows up, that defendant, who is the counterclaimant, the counterclaimant or counterplaintiff in the other court, outranks him. And that court, that first court, is under his jurisdiction. They can't proceed without his permission. And so he can be effective in that court as well. We'll get into that a little more. Okay, so, but let me tell you what a court really is. Okay? Let's see. Anything I need to back up? What is a court? This rule here, I consider the most important rule of all. You're familiar with court rules, you're familiar with statutes, codes, whatever. This is the most important rule. A court is a stage upon which the sovereign conducts his show so as to satisfy the rest of the world that his decision is a good one. Okay? Whenever you write your legal papers, always keep in mind that the American people have been fundamentally disarmed. In olden days, if you got a court judgment, you went out and enforced it yourself. Took your gun with you if necessary. But now, if you were to try to do that, it just complicates things. Now we've delegated it to the sheriff. We get a writ of execution on a judgment, take it over to the sheriff, and he's the one who does the shooting, okay, or the enforcing. So with that situation, what this means is that when you conduct your court case and you come to your judgment, which you would write yourself, you're relying on the sheriff to enforce it. Well, I can just see how it would be if the sheriff wasn't in agreement with you. Okay? You contact him, you say, I want you to enforce this judgment. Here's a writ of execution issued by the clerk. Well, first of all, you might have trouble with the clerk who doesn't agree with you. She will pussyfoot around or dance around and try not to issue it in the first place. But once you get past that stage and you take it to the sheriff, if he's against you, you know, he'll call up the person and say, hey, I've got this writ of execution against you. I'll be out there at 2 o'clock. Will you be there? Defendant says, sure. So the sheriff goes out there. Defendant's not there. Sheriff goes back, oh, well, I couldn't find him. Okay? So in practical terms, you're not going to get that judgment enforced if the sheriff is against you. Here, you've got to understand that the court is a stage. When you put together your case, you want to make it credible to the ordinary folks who unfortunately are ignorant of all this information. So your case has to be educational in nature. You have to educate these people as to what the common law is. You've got to educate them as to why you have the authority that you do to do what you're doing. Otherwise, they're going to say, oh, you're crazy. Everybody knows the judge is the only one that issues an order. Okay? Somebody wake up, Fred. Okay. So that's what a court is. Keep that in mind. This rule overrides all other rules that you have to follow. Okay? What good is a court case if nobody's going to back you up on it? All right. So that's what a court is. Now, a court can take several forms. Oh, time.
40 minutes in.
Okay. So a court can take various forms. For example, you have equity court, you have law court, you have court of the exchequer, you have admiralty courts, you have administrative courts. There's all kinds of courts. So when you form your court, you choose what form to have. Well, in my book, there's only one form of court to have, and that's a court of record. Okay? So what is a court of record? Well, a court of record, back to the 150%. Read that in back. Can you see that? Okay. A court of record generally has a seal. Okay? That's number one. Number two, it has the power to fine or imprison for contempt. Okay? Now, if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, the fifth edition and later, that's what you'll find in it. The remaining two requirements, number one generally has a seal. You have the power to fine or imprison for contempt, and it keeps a record of the proceedings. Okay? So the requirements 1, 2, and 3 you'll find in Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition and later. The 4th and 5th requirements you will not find in that dictionary. You will find it in the 4th edition of Black's Law Dictionary and the earlier editions. The first 4 editions of Black's Law Dictionary are essentially law-oriented. The remaining editions are policy-oriented. The power structure wants certain things out of the court system, and so they have the power to set the rules. Well, although they have the power to set the rules, they don't necessarily have power to change the rules. And we have rules which are very traditional, and the courts are very dedicated to the idea of res judicata, or we have ways we've done before, and we're going to do it the same way in the future. So rather than change the rules, what they do is they change the reference materials. So by leaving out the other two requirements, they're not inconvenienced by people having that knowledge. Okay? Well, look at this. The requirement number 4, proceeding according to the common law, not statutes or codes. See, all the courts are courts of record that are courts of record have to proceed according to the common law procedure. That pretty well puts a chink in the armor of the power structure that likes it. You see, the statutes and codes are the result of pressure groups, lobbyists, and so forth. These are all what you might call rules of man. The common law is God's law, or the rule of the sovereign people. Okay? And so the common law takes precedence over the statutory law. Now, you had something you brought up about that.
No.
Somebody did.
Richard did.
Oh, Richard. That's right. Okay, Richard.
Why not me?
Come on, Richard.
Oh, no. I was. That's what.
Out with it.
What I did is I brought in a code, a California Civil Code, section 22.2. And it states here that common law of England, so far as it is not repugnant or inconsistent with the Constitution of the United States or the constitutional laws of this state, is the rule of decisions in all the courts of this state.
Now, pass that up, please. Thank you. Okay, section 22.2. Right, well, what this section does is it puts the equity law above the common law. This is in direct conflict with the Seventh Amendment, which puts the common law above the equity law. See, the Seventh Amendment says, hey, whatever the jury decides, that's it. Okay, even the Supreme Court in a decision it made, some of you may know it, the Supreme Court said that what the jury decides is final, even in the teeth of the facts and the law. They can say somebody's innocent regardless of what the law and the facts say. A fully empowered jury, their decision is the decision of the sovereign people. The sovereigns are above the government and therefore is not reviewable by any court other than according to the rules of the common law. In other words, it can be reviewed by other sovereign people. If you get a crazy jury, fine, you can get a new jury who will re-decide. So why do they have this section 22.2, which says the common law of England, so far as it is not repugnant to or inconsistent with the Constitution of the United States, is the rule of decision in all the courts of the state? Well, what they've done, here's the concept. If you have a home, and I have a home, and I go visiting in your home, I will ask permission to do whatever I want to do in your home. I am subject to the law of your home. Okay, what's called, by the way, the law of the domicile. On the other hand, if you're visiting my home, you now become subject to the law of my home. Okay? Well, what they've done here is they said, in the equity court, in other words, the equity home, if we don't have a rule, we'll reach over to the other home and find out what their law is, the common law, and we'll apply it. Otherwise, when we make up a rule, that will override. So, on the other hand, if you set up your court under the common law, then you can reach over and pull in equity law to cover a situation, but the common law will be superior. So that's all this is. You see, statutes and codes are actually the equity. Okay? Statutes and codes are superseded by common law if you have the common law starting first, if you're in the common law home. But as soon as you dedicate to the equity law, then they give credence to the common law, but the equity law will take superiority. The equity law will take superiority. And what is equity law? It boils down to whatever the king wants, or if he's not around, it's whatever his chancellor wants. Discretion. Okay? So, that section 22.2 is pretty meaningless. I was in court one time, and the judge told me, he says, the common law has no standing in this court. I knew that. I said to him, yes, but in Miranda versus Arizona, the court said that where substantive rights are concerned, there shall be no rules to abrogate them. Well, what are substantive rights? That's common law rights. Okay? So the judge agreed to me. As long as I didn't say common law, he'd agree with me. He didn't want to blow the scene in front of his attorneys, So I let him get away with that. I just said it a different way. All right. So anyway, I want you to know that number four, proceeding according to the common law, is in a court of record. And the fifth, you have the word tribunal and you have the word magistrate. The tribunal is the entity that makes the judgment. The magistrate is any individual who has been given some sort of authority and is on the public payroll. Okay? All judges are magistrates. Now here's what the rule says. The tribunal is independent of the magistrate. How about that? Okay? So who's the tribunal? If the judge can't make a decision, if all the authority for making a decision has been over here on the tribunal, who is the tribunal? Well, it's the king of the court. So if you, in your sovereign capacity, as one of the people of the jurisdiction, create your court, you're the tribunal. That's what kings do. And the only way the defendant can wrest that power away from you is if he calls for a jury of sovereigns. Okay? So a fully empowered jury would be a jury of sovereigns. They take over. Let me explain where the jury concept comes from so that you can understand what it's about. Back in olden days, the juries, but the nobility had their private armies. They were like little kingdoms themselves. And if there was a contention between a couple of nobility, all they had to do was go out there in the field with their armies and duke it out. Okay? The problem is that was kind of destructive. So somehow the nobility figured it out. And what would happen is that one of the two, typically the defending nobleman, would call on 12 other noblemen. And the 12 other noblemen would take over and say, okay, what's going on here? You guys tell us what's going on, we'll decide. Whatever decision they made, it ended up 13 armies against one army. And that resulted peace in the realm. Okay? Because who's stupid enough to pit his army against 13 other armies? Okay? So that is conceptually what our jury system is about. It's come down to us where there's no armies involved, but nevertheless, it's a highly respected concept. It was especially made respectful by William Penn. That's the fellow that Pennsylvania was named after. And basically, he was a Quaker. The king had outlawed all the competing churches. And although the door had a padlock on it, he had his congregation meet with him in the streets. And he got arrested for violating the king's law. And so they arrested him and prosecuted him. And I remember reading that when he went into court, the marshal ordered him to put his hat on. And when he got in the court, he was fined for contempt of court for having his hat on in court. So justice hasn't changed in the past few hundred years. So what happened was that the jury decided that he was innocent. Back in those days, if a jury decided you were innocent, then the jury suffered the penalty. They went to jail. Okay? Well, the presumption was the accusation was true. So if you're going to decide against the king, well, then that's fine, but you can go to jail too. And that's what happened. Well, the head of the jury, he was a tough character. As I recall, he owned a shipping business or something. But whatever. He, as when they came out and delivered their decision, the jury told them that they had to go back and reconsider, which they did. They reconsidered, they came out, and they found him not guilty again. So when they went in a third time, William Penn yelled out at them, "Remember your countrymen," or words to that effect. And the head of the jury yelled back, "We will." Okay. Anyway, they came back with a third verdict of not guilty. So the judge confined them to jail. They would be confined with no food and just tobacco and drink, I think it was, or something like that. Or maybe no food or tobacco, just bread and water. Some deal like that. And so they were in jail for a couple of weeks. And finally somebody did a habeas corpus, and the higher-ups came down with the order to finish this case and let William Penn free. So that's kind of a little background on our jury system. And it was that particular case that earned a tremendous respect for the jury system. Okay. Back up. Is everybody bored?
No.
Okay.
Fascinating.
Okay. Back to this. Okay. So the court of record has those basic requirements. There's what's called a nisi prius court. A nisi prius court is a court that occurs. Nisi means without. Prius means prior. So a nisi prius court is a court that exists without prior objection. So all the courts typically that you see in operation are nisi prius courts. People don't object mainly because they didn't realize that there's another court system available to them. Okay? Now you have superior court versus the inferior court. Okay? And just to show you how important this is, let's see if I can expand that one. Here is what the Supreme Court has to say about a court of record. It said, the judgment of a court of record, whose jurisdiction is final, is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. Then they went on to say, it is as conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the fact by deciding it. In other words, any decision by a court of record cannot be reviewed by any court, not even the Supreme Court. The court of record is the highest court of the land, higher than the Supreme Court. It's logical. The court of record is the people's court. The people are sovereign. The people are the creators of the government. It is the people that are authorized to run this government the way they want to. So when they make a decision in a court of record, that's the people speaking, the sovereign speaking to the servants. That's why their decision is not reviewable. Okay? So, I happen to like a court of record. Now, I told you that sometimes what I will do is I will issue an order removing a judge's decision. Where does that authority come from? Well, first of all, you know what a court of record is. Let's see if I can find it. Go back to court. Nope, not that one. Let's go to not that one. Sorry about that. There we go. Maybe it's under this one. Okay, this is the one. Go back up to size here. This is what the California Code says. If you look up the Bagley-Keene Act or the Brown Act. The Brown Act of the California Government Code section 11120. And here's what it says. It says, the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. Is that a powerful statement or what? This is in the codes. When I go to court and I'm correcting a judge, I let them know I do not yield my sovereignty. Okay? I'm not accountable to higher authority. Now look, you guys, you gotta pay attention. That's what I indicate. I don't say it that way to the judge. I'm respectful. But that's the message I'm delivering. He absolutely cannot take the people over. The people of the state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. That's in the Brown Act. Now you have the Bagley-Keene Act, section 54950 of the government code. And it says, down in the second paragraph, the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. Word for word is the same, excepting for one word. The word state is capitalized here, and the other one is not. Okay? But the point is that the people are sovereign, the people lay down the rules, and the servants are supposed to obey. Okay? So that's where my authority comes from. In addition to that, I'm not sure where it is in my website. However, I'll just tell you what it is. If you go to the California Constitution, 1879 version. Now, look, there's a lot of discussion that people have about, hey, the 1849 is the real Constitution. The 1879 Constitution was never ratified by the Congress, so therefore it's no good and all that. I don't pay any attention to that. What I do when I go to court, I know that everybody in that system, the judges, the attorneys, they're all attuned to the 1879 Constitution. It may be a fraud, but hey, I'm in my sovereign capacity. And as such, I have the unlimited power to contract. So I will contract with them that we will use the 1879 Constitution. Now, I don't have to overtly contract. I just assume it. They're going to go by it, all right? Well, what does the 1879 Constitution say for California? It says in Article 6, Section 1, that the Supreme Court, the appellate courts, and the superior courts are all courts of record. Is that cool or what? What's a court? It's the person and the suit of the sovereign. What is a common law court, a court of record? It is a court proceeding according to the common law, not according to statutes. It's a court whose decision is final. It's a court that outranks the Supreme Court. What more could I ask for? I love the 1879 Constitution. Because once I open my court, that's it. It's now my rules, not theirs. Okay? Keeping in mind the first rule, however, which is that a court is a stage upon which I, the sovereign, put a show to convince the rest of the world I'm right. So in one sense, I'm not free from all the rules. In terms of making a public impression or an impression upon all the slaves that are out there, including the sheriff and such, I conform quite a bit to the rules. But what I have found is that the rules really aren't so bad. The real problem is the discretion of the judges, or the lack of discretion. All right. Let's go to... Okay. For those of you who are engaged in tax issues, all right, I highly recommend that when you get your 90-day letter, I think that's what it's called, you get your 90-day letter saying that you have a 90-day window during which you can go to the tax court. I highly recommend you go to tax court. Okay? Here's why. Okay, 26 U.S.C. 7441. Quote, there is hereby established under Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States a court of record to be known as the United States Tax Court. The members of the tax court shall be the chief judge and the judges of the tax court. Notice that. It doesn't say what their duties are, does it? There's no duties prescribed for the judge. Those judges, you remember what I said? They're all magistrates. Right? The tribunal is independent of the magistrate in a tax court. Who is the tribunal? Who is the sovereign of the court?
You are,
because you're the one opening the case. And because you are opening the case, you're the plaintiff, or the petitioner is another word, okay? You are the petitioner, and they are the respondents or defendants. So it's your court. And the only way they can beat that, well, there's two ways they can beat it. They can either break the law, or they can ask for a jury. Well, they're not going to ask for a jury in the tax court, because they don't even know it could happen. Theoretically, it could, but they're not going to do it. In fact, I've never had a jury in any court that was a court of record. 1 minute, okay. So, I suggest you use a tax court. It's a wonderful vehicle. They will fight you tooth and nail, by the way. You'll create a big fight. But the law is on your side. And that's federal. And by the way, the U.S. District Court and the Supreme Court and the Appellate Court, they're all courts of record, too, in the federal system. So if you're the moving party, you can force the issues by your own authority. All right, then we have here the Confirmatio Cartarum and the Magna Carta. Magna Carta is rather interesting. We have this interpretation. There's a couple of interesting things, but let me just point two of them here. No sheriff, constable, coroners, or other bailiffs of ours shall hold the pleas of our crown. That's Article 24 of the Magna Carta. That means that the sheriff, the cops, none of those guys can bring a charge against you. Okay? They cannot hold the pleas of the crown. In other words, they cannot bring a case against you. The nobility was sovereign relative to those characters. Okay? Secondly, here's something that you might be familiar with. I forgot about this. No sheriff, nor bailiff of ours, nor anyone else shall take the horses or carts of any freeman for transport unless by the will of that freeman. Anybody ever have their car taken away from them? Okay. Now, henceforth the writ, which is called precipice, shall not be served on anyone for any holding so as to cause a free man to lose his court. It's your court when you open up your case. They cannot issue an order. That's all. A precipice technically is an order issued against property. But basically it says a writ cannot be issued. Let's see. There's one more requirement. Let's go back here. Here it is. Article 38. No bailiff, on his own simple assertion, shall henceforth put anyone to his law without producing faithful witnesses in evidence. What is witnesses? Two or more witnesses. Okay? A cop cannot make an accusation without having two non-cops, non-government people, as witnesses. Boy, is that a barrier against the government going after you. Okay? That's Magna Carta number 38. So, On the website, you'll find that under the interpretation of Magna Carta and Confirmatio Cautarum. Now, in the Confirmatio Cautarum, yes, this was issued in the year 1297. That was 82 years after the Magna Carta. Okay, King Edward, I think he was the child king, and but anyway, King Edward, when he came into power, the nobility got him to produce this Confirmatio Cautarum. And here's the key thing that really makes this great. It says, this is the king speaking, that our justices, sheriffs, mayors, and other ministers, which under us have the laws of our land to guide, shall allow the said charters. We're talking about the Magna Carta and the Forest Charter. Those were the two charters. Shall allow the said charters pleaded before them in judgment of all their points. That is to wit, the Great Charter as the common law. So in plain English, what they're saying is that if you are, you're being accused, you can say, I want the common law, and the Magna Carta is the common law. Okay? And the king must accept it. The government must accept the Magna Carta as the common law. And that's good law today. Okay? And say, if you, as a defendant, demand that this charter, the Magna Carta, be the common law, they must allow it to be. They have to follow the rules. The common law of England is recognized, you've heard it, section 22.2 of the government code, right? That's their deal. However, if you're doing a counterclaim, you can supersede that. But they have to allow you to plead the Magna Carta as the common law. Okay? You will have to educate them because they don't know that. Okay. So enough of that, I guess. Okay, let's talk about habeas corpus. All right? I'm just going to read this because it says it better than I can. See if I can enlarge it a little. Okay. There are two definitions for habeas corpus, one formal and the other substantive. Remember, substantive has to do with common law rights, okay, or the common law. The formal definition may be found in any law dictionary. This essay is about the substantive definition. The substantive definition of habeas corpus is not found in the dictionaries, but rather it's found in the history books. So, habeas corpus basically means you have the body. That's Latin. But what they're really saying is that there's a question of jurisdiction here, and they should bring forth the body for immediate examination. And if the court finds that there was no jurisdiction in the first place, then it doesn't matter what the law says. And therefore, the person should be immediately cut loose. Okay? But anyhow, this is a little bit of background. In the early days before Magna Carta, the king had many court systems operating. For example, courts of common pleas, exchequer, king's bench, chancery, and so forth. Each court had its jurisdiction defined. Of course, as an arm of government, courts are simply another form of bureaucracy, okay, with assigned functions. Like any bureaucracy, they always want to expand their jurisdictions. If a court exceeded its jurisdiction, a person could go to the proper court that should have had jurisdiction and ask for an order directing the errant court to stop its proceedings and release jurisdiction to the proper court. The phrase habeas corpus, meaning you have the body, was put at the end of pleadings to the second court, asking that the first court be required to produce the body if it was being held. In its most common form, the full formal phrase for habeas corpus was habeas corpus ad subjiciendum. Okay? Of course, you might surmise that would pit one court bureaucracy against another. The habeas corpus worked quite well because as long as the defendant was not a common enemy to both bureaucracies, one bureaucracy would not miss any opportunity to put down a competing bureaucracy. The practical result of all this is that the defendant would often be ordered released, which was the second court's way of telling the first court that it didn't know what it was doing and it strayed from its original jurisdiction. In other words, it exceeded its jurisdiction. The habeas corpus as a byproduct of bureaucratic turf protection tended to serve personal liberty as well. Over the centuries, it became known as the Great Writ of Liberty. It was the only known privilege or right that became stronger with the passage of time. Can you get it? These different courts are protecting their turf. But the guy in the middle, the person is accused, he's just a pawn in this deal. But habeas corpus became stronger and stronger over time because, hey, this is a great tool for protecting our bureaucracy, see? So that's what habeas corpus was. It was something going on between two courts. Now, I want you to understand that, well, we say it in the next paragraph. In summary, habeas corpus is the process of one court sitting in judgment of another court's jurisdiction. It is not a civil or criminal proceeding, but rather, it is a family fight between courts. That is why, even though you find habeas corpus rules in the civil procedure books, for example, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and the California Code of Civil Procedure, the procedures stand somewhat alone, independent of the rest of the procedures in those codes. The reason is obvious. Why would a court burden itself with procedural requirements? That stuff is okay for outsiders, not part of the court system. For example, plaintiffs, defendants, and attorneys. But it's not okay for judges themselves. See, the procedures are far simpler. To file a habeas corpus in federal court is $5. Okay? It's not a court procedure at all. Okay? It's not a suit. In America, everyone can be sovereign. When you move for habeas corpus, you are activating your own court, which is separate and distinct from their court. You sit in judgment of the jurisdiction of their court. When you order them to produce the injured party and to demonstrate the injury, and when they fail to produce, then your court can issue an order to dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction. Your court is a court of record and takes precedence over the statutory court. You set up your court of record. You say, okay, here's our court of record. Who has jurisdiction over the sovereign? Well, the sovereign is always subject to his own court. In fact, there's is it in Shakespeare? They apply this concept. This king was approached by his chief magistrate, and he was presented the facts that they had a defendant who apparently was cheating on his wife, and they wanted to know what to do. And so the king expressed it. This is what you should do. So then they arrested the king because he was the one that they were going to accuse. Okay? And they subjected him to his own rule. Okay? I think that was a Shakespearean play. I'm not sure. Any experts in Shakespeare here? Anyway, so the king is subject to his own court. When the sovereign is installed, if you watch the English coronations, you will see that the sovereign is conducted up to the throne by a person who has his sword drawn, okay? And this is symbolic to represent that the sovereign is subject to the court and that the sovereign could be executed by the court if the sovereign misbehaves. So you're always subject to your own court. So be careful who you allow to staff your court. Okay? All right. So in a nutshell, that's what you have. Here in America, what they did is they combined the courts. They're trying to get rid of this influence of the law versus the equity. They're trying to run everything according to equity because in equity, the chancellor has complete discretion. Whereas in a court of record, he's not even allowed to make a decision. You see? So you want to have a court of record, you do not want to operate in equity. So be very careful about allowing the judge to do anything. I will sometimes issue an order removing a decision of a judge, even though he made a decision in my favor, because I don't want to allow a precedent of letting him make decisions in my court. Okay? All right. Let's get on over to more about habeas corpus. Now, each of you should have received a copy of the CD. Yeah. Okay. Did everybody get one?
No.
All right. Well, we got... Here we go. Whoops. There you go.
Here, I'll hand him out. Yeah,
go ahead.
Bill of
Bankruptcy? No, he's got it.
Courts of record?
No. A bankruptcy court is a constitutional court. It's basically an equity court. It's going by statutes and codes. So it's an equity court. We did an interesting thing one time, though. In a bankruptcy proceeding, the individual opens the court. But in what happens is that the judge will appoint a temporary trustee. But the trustee represents the creditors, okay? The trustee is the attorney for the creditors. He's not neutral at all, okay? And his job is to make sure that all the creditors are treated proportionately according to the level of debt and that they all follow the rules. So that's what the trustee's about. But the trustee's only temporary in the beginning. Then they'll have a creditors meeting, and the first creditors meeting, the creditors elect the trustee, or if no creditors show up, the trustee is reappointed by the court and he becomes a permanent trustee, okay, which means he's the permanent attorney of record for the representing the creditors. What we did one time, we recognized that principle. So the individual declared bankruptcy, and on the day that they had the creditors meeting, we filed with the clerk of court a paper. Remember, this is the debtor's court at this point. We filed a paper discharging the present trustee and appointing our own individual as a trustee. Okay? Then we had the creditors meeting. Of course, the attorney that was the trustee, the temporary trustee, didn't understand what was going on in the beginning anyway, didn't understand these concepts, but did not accept the idea that she was no longer trustee. So what we did is when they had the creditors meeting, she made a call for creditors and no creditors attended. And when she made the call, we repeated her words with our own trustee, okay? And so when she announced that the meeting was closed, we announced that the meeting was closed because she was illegal. Ours was the only legitimate one because we had on file this thing. Actually, that case never went any further. It eventually got dismissed for lack of action. But we did that. Nobody ever argued other than the local trustee. So... anyway, keep that in mind if you ever want to pull that stunt. Yeah. Yes?
Okay, somebody was telling me that they filed as a creditor. Now, they're already in a bankruptcy
Hold on a second. Do you have the mic pointed toward?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, somebody's in a Chapter 13, and they have a homestead exemption on their house. Uh-huh. So they have equity in their house. So they filed that they are a creditor for the value of their homestead exemption. Uh-huh. And as a creditor in their own Chapter 13.
Sure.
And have you ever heard of anything like that?
Yes, I have. And I've also heard that some people have, when they made out their bankruptcy papers, they did not show the property as security for the loan. They listed the loan as an unsecured debt, right, and listed the property as a, as an asset that they had. Okay?
Right.
So they've done that. The truth is, I don't know anything about bankruptcy. I just know some highlights. That's all. So I'm not prepared to talk about bankruptcy here. But habeas corpus, we can talk about. So let me go to the habeas corpus disc. Okay, habeas corpus. This is what you got on your disc. This is a private research collection. It is neither for sale nor for general distribution. The reason I put that there is because I copied the habeas corpus handbook that an attorney had put together. And so under the copyright laws, there are certain things that you can do so long as you're not engaged in commerce. So this is why you're all getting this as a gift. But it contains information from different sources. You'll find conflicting opinions in here, but these are sources that I considered each valuable in its own right, and so I included it on this disc. The first section here has to do with do-it-yourself information. There's the habeas corpus handbook by Russell. Now, that particular handbook, which I put first on the list, that's the one that gives you the detailed information, tells you exactly what words to put on it. It explains the recent laws as of whatever its copyright date is. So I have used this. In one case that I used it, I got some feedback from people who were experienced in this field. I was told that that habeas corpus always gets rejected, and yet we got through the first point of rejection. Okay? So something must be okay there. In that handbook, he recommends that you use only Supreme Court cases, not any other cases. And he gives you the wording and the Supreme Court cases. Then there are these other, there's various checklists. We have the habeas corpus overview, which I have already read to you. Okay? Here's investigation and presentation, state and federal statistical analysis. These are just essays that I picked up from various points. These are for, you might say, general information. I've already covered sovereignty of the people, republic versus democracy, in order to help you to understand this, what a court of record, and so forth. You've already been through most of this information. And I have a complete copy of the 1679 Habeas Corpus Act if you want to punish yourself by reading it. Okay? But I have a disclaimer on here. We have examples. Here's some papers. Here's a model habeas corpus by the Blakely decision. In order to discharge the case, if you ever get to the point where you are going to issue the order, you have a model to follow. And then we got some authorities. CalJUR 1922, California Habeas Corpus Codes, Federal Habeas Corpus, some cases, Fay versus Noya, Schneckloth versus Bustamante, and Blakely versus Washington. What we're going to talk about today is this first one. I'm going to leave this other up to you. Oh, and here's some specialists. Here's an attorney who operates out of Northern California, and here's an attorney that operates out of Southern California.
The first one, the same as the one.
The first one's the one that wrote the book. The book is very reasonably priced. I think he wants $49 for it, and it's a little gold mine of information. So even though I copied it, I suggest that you check with him to see if you can get the latest, because laws do change. And they're busy changing the laws because they're trying to figure out ways to get rid of habeas corpus. State of Washington is my most recent experience with habeas corpus. And what they have done up there is they have they've passed some codes which define a procedure which is like habeas corpus. Okay? And the case that I have is now in the Supreme Court of Washington. And one of the questions that I raised in the appeal from the appellate court was, can the legislature pass a statute that to replace a constitutional mandate? Well, the answer is obvious, but they're going to have to wrestle with that one, because it is apparent from the policies, from what we saw in how the appellate court operated, it is apparent that that habeas corpus on a constitutional level is anathema. They do not want anything to do with the Constitution, but it's still there, folks. So, I raised that supremacy question. Never raise a question unless you know the answer. Yes? Don't they make a lot of money on the judgments? Well, of course they do. I mean, fines, for example. They make lots of money. In California, so far as I know, all the judges subscribe to CalPERS, which is their retirement program, and so every one of them can be disqualified on issues relating to banks. You know, so there's some interesting work being done by various people in tracking down just exactly who owns the court system, and appears to be very private, not at all government. Okay, but those are issues outside today's discussion. Let's go into the habeas corpus handbook. So this is copyright 5th edition, summer 2011, so it's fairly recent. And you can go here to order the latest edition. For those of you who are watching the video, let's see if we can... Nope, not there. I guess... That's where you can go on the internet, I guess, to order it. But if we go to the last page, I think we can probably find the order information there. There you go. $49.99. If you're a prisoner, then it's $39.99. Okay? At least he gives you a little break anyway. And it applies only if the book is paid for personally by a prisoner from a prison account or with a state check and must be claimed at the time of purchase. Okay, they're complete and include shipment. So the guy's very reasonable, I think. And this is his address. It's the Law Offices of Russell & Russell, California Habeas Handbook, 2299 Sutter Street, S-U-T-T-E-R, Sutter Street, San Francisco, California, 94115. So that's a picture of him and his wife. Okay. So that's where you can get that book and a little blurb about him. So here is table of contents. Basically, I went through and renumbered these things so that they would fall in order. And so we'll go to the table of contents here so you can see what's there. I'm sorry to say that what you're looking at is a photo scan of the pages. So unfortunately, the pages are not searchable with a text searcher. So that's the way it goes. basically, here's our table of contents. Who needs this book? Your habeas clock is ticking. There's some very stringent requirements now. Again, the government is trying to avoid habeas corpus. So there's some very these stringent requirements. I think you have 1 year to raise the issue of habeas corpus. And when you raise the issue in the state court, the federal clock is still ticking. So you can't wait till the last minute and expect the clock to be pushed back. Okay, so I think it's 1 year. We'll see. We'll confirm that when we get deeper into it. habeas corpus yesterday and today, state habeas corpus, federal habeas corpus. The essence of the state habeas corpus is that you make it federal. Why? Because then you can transfer. Once you've gone up the state ladder, you get to the Supreme Court, you can then jump over to the federal system and go up that way. But you have to have federal issues in order to do that. So in his How to Do It handbook, everything's Supreme Court decisions that you base it on. Okay? State procedural defaults, dealing with the AEDPA, that is the act that deals with habeas corpus and the government's attempt to restrict it. How to fill out the petition form. Let me tell you something. You do not have to use the petition form. Okay? They have the form there for you. But here's what's wrong with using the form. Their form kind of leaves things out. Okay? So, you should make your own form. Basically follow the standard format, just like always, but make sure you include everything. Include everything that's on their form, plus anything else you can think of that's proper for a habeas corpus. Okay? Stating the grounds. What are the grounds for a habeas corpus? Now, you'll notice that goes for the next 21 pages. Okay? That's the biggest section of the book, I think. Well, maybe not. 41 pages for federal habeas corpus. Okay? But this stating the grounds is really the important part. And I was able to use a lot of the information there word for word, okay, with very little modification. And if you want to hire him to do habeas corpus, he'll do it. I called him up and I said, I've got a habeas corpus situation. How much would you charge? Well, he offered $15,000 for, you know, well, I didn't have $15,000 handy, so I ended up doing it myself. But he's available if you got the money. But I think the reason he has it set so high, frankly, is because he doesn't like to work. And his instructions are so clear that I have a feeling you don't really need him. You know, if you pay attention, he's got it together. And he has some closing thoughts on it, along with an appendix. Okay, so let's go back to the table of contents. And let's see. Let's talk about your habeas corpus clock is ticking. Huh? Oh. A critically important feature of AEDPA, that's the act that restricts habeas corpus, is the one-year statute of limitations, which is applicable to all federal habeas corpus petitions and Section 2255 motions. Now, this is another trick they're doing. They're trying. You can make a petition, but you can also make a motion. They would prefer that you make a motion in equity instead of a constitutional petition because they have greater latitude of decision. Okay? So when I put together a petition, that's what I call it, a petition. I do not make motions for habeas corpus. Okay. So because the federal courts are usually where the action is on habeas corpus, and because no federal district court will consider the merits of a habeas corpus petition filed beyond the statute of limitations date, every prisoner must be fully aware of AEDPA's statute of limitations before embarking on the habeas corpus journey. Therefore, before that journey begins, we'll take a quick look now at the overall structure of AEDPA's statute of limitations, and then after you've got a basic knowledge of state and federal habeas corpus, we'll come back in Chapter 7 to see how the nuts and bolts of the statute of limitations actually work. Now, I'd like to point out something interesting here. You have a choice. You can either do things the state way, or you can do it your way. Okay? If you do it your way, you got a fight on your hands. But then, if you're willing to fight, for purposes of winning, that is, then by all means, I'd suggest doing it your way. I'd much rather make the decision myself than have a judge make the decision. On the other hand, if you have a crystal clear case, maybe it's better to just kind of go along with the state's plan, their program, because it's too clear. They don't have much wiggle room even in their own system. So that's kind of a strategy question, not a legal question. Which do you do? Which system you use? But notice this. It says right here that how no federal district court will consider the merits of habeas corpus petition filed beyond the statute of limitations. But what if you're at common law? What if you're in your sovereign capacity? Remember this. Your court of record, is above the Supreme Court. You're outside the system. You're actually outside the Constitution. The Constitution of the United States says that the judicial power of the United States is available in all cases in law and equity where an issue arises under the Constitution or the laws of the United States. So here's the issue that arose under the Constitution. Who has the jurisdiction? Does my court have jurisdiction over me, or does their court have jurisdiction over me? So, because they were the first court, I will run over to the other court and say, hey, that first court is encroaching on your area without cause. And that other court is the sovereign court that has jurisdiction over me, the sovereign. Okay? Does that make sense? So, remember, you read all the literature that's published, you know, the regular literature, and you would think that habeas corpus was a statutory procedure. But in fact, it reaches back into the common law, and it reaches back into the question, not whether or not they have jurisdiction. The real question is, which court has the jurisdiction? And if your court is supposed to have jurisdiction over you, what is the basis for them taking jurisdiction? Well, there's only two bases. Okay? The first basis, and the most important, is, was there an injured party? By the way, never admit that you are injured. Okay? When they come in and they arrest you, and they beat you, and you have a pool of blood around your feet as you're standing in the courtroom, and they point out that you're injured, you say, no. I'm not injured. I'm merely undergoing a reasonable inquisition in search of the injured party. However, if the injured party is never found, then yes, I could become the injured party. But we won't know that until we determine whether or not there is an injured party. See, in habeas corpus, all they need is to find it, or actually not just habeas corpus, but in any proceeding where jurisdiction is in question, all they have to do is find an injured party. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, if it's the plaintiff that's doing this. So we're in search of the injured party. And so here, your court has jurisdiction over you until you injure somebody, and then the other court can take jurisdiction. So make sure you haven't injured anybody. An injury does not mean a broken bone. Injury means that you deprive somebody of their rights, or you had a contract that you violated and they lost money and so forth. Yes, sir.
So somebody's in jail and they've been in jail for over a year,
mm-hmm.
and that would put them beyond the statute of limitations according to the de facto.
Possibly so. Which
then
is
they have their, then they have a common law availability of drawing their own court, but how do you get that in front of somebody that's going to let them out of jail?
Well, that's why you have to be the petitioner, okay? You are the petitioner. You're the moving party, and you specify that it's a court of record. The question came up, who's the guilty party here? Who's the one that brought up that question of a court of record? How do you establish a court of record? Was it you? Somebody hears, okay, well, somebody asked, how do you get into a court of record?
Well, I asked.
Yeah.
I was talking to
Okay, you don't get into a court of record. That's not, a court of record does not exist until it's decreed so by the sovereign.
I guess my question was, how do you get them to recognize it without, when they pretty much shut you down entirely?
Okay, there's theory and there's practice, okay? In these sessions that we have, I talk about theory. I don't talk about practice, okay? I will comment on it, but that's not the main focus of
can
what...
You comment on comes now one of the people...
Well, I'm going to do that.
You've
got to let me get my disclaimer out, okay?
I'm sorry.
All right. So, but our emphasis is on the theory, because you have to have the theory so that then you can operate in the practical side. But the what you do is... When you put together your legal paper, your first paper, which is commonly called a lawsuit or an action at law or something like that, you say, I am, and you state your name, comma, one of the people of, and you state the jurisdiction, like one of the people of California or one of the people of the United States, comma, and in this court of record, complain against the following, and you list just the names of the individuals. Do not list their offices that they occupy. Okay? Just their names. Right there, you've established your sovereignty because the people are sovereign, right? You said, I'm one of the people. You've established the common law because, after all, it's a court of record. You've suspended the judge because, after all, the tribunal is independent of the magistrate. Okay? And because you're the sovereign of the court, you're the only one who makes decisions around here. You are the tribunal. Okay? So that's how you establish your court of record. Yes?
Okay, so you do all of that, and they ignore it.
Okay, on the practical side, you have a fight on your hands. So, yes, they will ignore it, but what they're doing, it isn't so much that they're lawless, although they are, by ignoring it. What they're doing is testing you. You know, if you blow it, well, too bad, you lose. And they're the ones that have the guns. Okay, so they're in charge. However, there is, I found, a certain amount of lawfulness if you show your mettle. In other words, you show that you know your stuff. And remember this, that what we do is two things. First, we surround the judge with the law that restricts him. The second thing we do is we protect the judge from his superiors, because he can always say, I was surrounded by the law, which is why I could not execute policy. Okay? When the judge figures that out, my experience has been they get real friendly. First of all, they've never seen a law case before, even though they might have been trained in it. And secondly, he's safe. You know, so... It works out.
You add that to your initial documents,
right,
to instruct them and inform them.
Well, all of the documents, there are examples of documents on the website. If you go to 1215.org/Q, and that's a lowercase Q, you will see an actual case where we did enforce a rebellion against a rebellious judge. This judge was absolutely, well, I like to say he was Hitler reincarnated. Okay, and what it was over in Torrance, California, and he would issue an order. We would issue a writ of error removing his order. Okay, then he would issue another order. So the second time we fined him for contempt of court, $1. We just fined him $1. Then he issued another order. We did another contempt. Well, it became apparent to me that this guy was in... This was a palace rebellion, okay? He's going against the sovereignty of the state. So, I had to do a lot of research. I'm actually happy about this case because it forced me to do research on what to do if you get a rebellious judge. And what I decided was I was going to let him establish a pattern. So, he kept issuing orders. I kept issuing writs of error and also contempt fines. And the fines got bigger and bigger, so we were hitting like $300-$400 per contempt. And then what I did is I issued a bench warrant for his arrest. and I delivered the bench warrant to the sheriff. Now, the sheriff is out of the control of the judge. He was fine as long as we were in his courtroom. You know, hey, contempt, so what? Make me pay, right? But then I gave this an order to the sheriff instructing, this is a court order, okay, instructing the sheriff to go to the judge and get from the judge merely a promise that he would obey another order that the sheriff also carried with him. Okay? Just get a promise. It could be verbal or written, but get a promise and report back to the court. So I made this as easy as I could for everybody to cooperate with no risk. Well, two things happened. The big thing that happened was that the judge suddenly became the nicest judge I ever met in my life. Okay? He was really a nice guy. The second thing that happened was that I had a chance to talk to the specific sheriff's deputy who had the responsibility of enforcing court orders. And he said, and of course I didn't tell him that I had written the orders, okay? It was somebody else's case. But he said to me, he says, well, this order is telling me to arrest the judge. And I said, well, I read the order myself. And I said, I didn't see that. And I said, what I saw was that he's just asking you to go to the judge and ask him to make a promise. And if he makes a promise, you report back to the court. The only time you arrest him is if he refuses. You're supposed to take him into custody and hold him until he does promise. Okay? So the sheriff's deputy said to me, well, he says, I didn't see that. He says, I'll have to go back and reread it. So I said, okay, yeah. So whether he did or not, I don't know. The judge was never arrested, but I'll tell you something. He was a sure nice judge. And what happened was that four felonies suddenly became a misdemeanor, single misdemeanor for passing a bad check. Credit for time served, some 470 days, by the way. And because the individual that was involved was very tough.
So basically what happened was that he made a disposition of the case, just got rid of it, and saved face.
Right, right. He offered... Look, he said he offered to the individual.
He got a win that somebody else would might not have taken.
Well, he made an offer to the individual, and the offer was credit for time served in return for a guilty plea, no fine, no probation, and immediate release. Okay? And so she said, I'll think about it. Well, as it turned out, he made a personal offer to her, but he was still in the jurisdiction of her court. Okay? So she took the offer, got out of jail, and her case is still potentially there. And that's another story in itself. Yes, sir?
Bill, when does the year start? The beginning of the second paragraph says obtain relief from a sentence.
Well, let's go to that.
Appeal. I mean, if you appeal your case, your sentence, wouldn't that be the beginning of, and it was decided, wouldn't that be beginning of a year from there?
Well, I don't think you can appeal a Supreme Court decision of the state without going into the federal. Okay? So anyway, let's read more here. Habeas corpus is a prisoner's last chance to obtain relief from a sentence that has been affirmed on direct appeal. Short of getting clemency from the governor, about as likely these days as finding a winning lottery ticket on your food tray, it is a prisoner's last opportunity to secure a sentence reduction, a reversal, or a new trial from the courts on the basis of that one's fundamental constitutional rights were denied. The writ of habeas corpus, which literally requires the state to produce the body of a prisoner to justify the basis for his or her conviction and imprisonment, has been an important part of our legal system and so forth, okay? So, in the two centuries between 1776 and the enactment of the AEDPA in 1996, there was never an arbitrary time limit on when a federal habeas corpus petition could be filed. Rather, the courts were willing to at least consider a habeas corpus petition on its merits whenever a serious constitutional law violation was brought to their attention, so long as the petitioner provided some reasonable explanation for any delay in filing the writ. So, as a result, even when a prisoner waited many years before filing, the courts would usually hear the petition on the merits so long as there was no evidence that the prisoner had deliberately bypassed filing earlier in order to get an unfair advantage, such as by delaying to file until key witnesses had disappeared or died. So, on April 24th, all that changed. For the first time in U.S. history, the AEDPA imposed a one-year statute of limitations on filing of all federal habeas corpus petitions throughout the country. Crudely put, a statute of limitation means if you snooze, you lose. Okay? With a few exceptions not applicable to most prisoners, the year begins to run when a person's conviction becomes final in state court following an unsuccessful direct appeal. There, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Oh, okay. All right, so that's when it starts.
Is there any exceptions to that, like if the judge is committing criminal acts?
Well, I can't answer that question because it's been too long since I've read this.
Well, we were thinking of a person who was convicted in a federal court, not a state court.
Right, right. So, can't answer that directly. This is why I provide the whole disc. Okay? All I'm remember, I only got 2 hours. All right, to talk. First, I had to give you a grounding, and then I had to give you some information. But you've got the whole package, so you should be able to get your information. Yes, Fred.
I'd like to bring up a question regarding Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4, which says to establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform rules on the subject of bankruptcy throughout the United States.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with habeas corpus.
No, I know, but
can't go into bankruptcy.
And I got 4 minutes left. Okay, we might run over, but I don't want to abuse the time. We might run over. Okay. All right. So the point that we're getting at is making you aware that you do have a time limit, and this book is an easy read. Believe me, it's designed for prisoners who are in there already. It's very good. I've used it, and so far I've had good results, okay? With the exception that I did lose the case and went to the Supreme Court of Washington, and they're taking their time studying it, okay? So I must have raised some issues. They didn't just do like they normally do, which is outright just dismiss it, you know, or deny. Okay, so here it is. All federal habeas corpus petitions must be filed before the AEDPA statute of limitations runs out. Although technically speaking, the AEDPA doesn't apply as a time limit on state habeas corpus petitions, state habeas corpus is most often used to exhaust claims so that they can be brought on federal habeas corpus, and a prisoner cannot have the federal statute told for a state habeas corpus petition that is filed after the statute of limitations has run out. Therefore, to the extent humanly possible, all federal and state habeas corpus petitions must be filed before the statute of limitations expires. And it says federal and state, so yeah, I guess it does apply. Again, that's equity.
Right.
All right? If you actually bring in a common law habeas corpus, constitutionally based, there is no constitutional time limit, so I believe that in the ultimate analysis, that AEDPA won't hold up, because how can you limit the Constitution? See? So, plus the fact that this is would be the sovereign's court, so you have, you're higher up on the pecking order. So these are untested theories that I'm giving you, but I think that if that were made an issue in your papers, there would be some success with that. All right, so anyway, that's the deal with that. Now, let's take a quick jump over to, see, he has habeas corpus yesterday and today, state habeas corpus, federal habeas corpus, and so forth. But let's jump to the grounds for habeas corpus, okay? Because the, you can read this. Like I said, it's an easy read. Okay. The guts of every habeas corpus petition is the section which includes the grounds for relief, also called the claims for relief. In the California form, the grounds are stated in response to questions 6 and 7. In the generic federal form, the grounds are included in questions in answer to question 12. Stating the grounds for the petition is the most challenging requirement of drafting the habeas corpus petition, and it requires an ability to state in concise fashion the facts on which a habeas corpus ground is based, along with the key case authority that supports each ground. Ideally, this should be done with the assistance of an experienced post-conviction lawyer. On the other hand, many of the prisoners who are reading this book are doing so precisely because their families don't have the money to hire a habeas corpus lawyer. Okay, so forth. And furthermore, now that the AEDPA requires that all habeas claims be based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision, I believe it is possible for even a prisoner with no legal training to successfully state a habeas corpus ground if that prisoner has access to a compendium of U.S. Supreme Court cases that have supported successful habeas corpus claims through the years. Okay, so you need cases that are proven. Okay, well, that's what it gives you. So let's see, let's go down here a ways, and here's his format. Here is inevitable discovery used without ongoing investigation. Here's the ground. The petitioner was convicted on the basis of evidence seized without a warrant on the basis of the inevitable discovery doctrine, despite the lack of an ongoing investigation. Okay? So that is DP-5. That's the right that's covered. And that is supported by Nix versus Williams, 467 U.S. 431, 1984. Gives you the specific case. Now, one second here. DP-5, what is that? Go back up here, and he gives you the abbreviations. All I have to do is find them for you, but they're up here. Here it is. DP is due process of law. RC is right to counsel. SS, right against unreasonable searches and seizures. FA, First Amendment right. FT, right to a fair trial. CON, equals right to confrontation of witnesses. JT, right to jury trial. And also, as some people say, right to trial by jury. Okay? And CUP is a right against cruel and unusual punishment. So he categorizes each of these. Okay? DP, RC, DP, and so forth. All right. So, and he gives you the specific wording to use. You adapt it to your case, but it's almost pre-written now for you. Miranda violation. Messiah violation. What's a Messiah violation? Well, that was Messiah versus U.S. Okay. Evidence used to convict the petitioner was obtained from the police by deliberately eliciting incriminating statements from the petitioner after he had been charged in violation of the right to counsel. Okay. You go through these, you can find dozens, literally dozens, of reasons to have a habeas corpus. I think when I did my habeas corpus, I don't know, I think I had at least 25 reasons or 30 reasons that I picked out of this list. So this is absolutely a useful tool. So I hope you're happy. Yes, sir, you have a question.
Yes, with the events taking place in this day and age, with the attempt to create laws that state that, or get judges to state that marshals, FBI, whoever, government agency,
TSA,
has a right to come in without a warrant, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. How does that impact here or vice versa?
Well, the legislature and the executive branch have a history of making up rules that violate the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question is you have to take it through the court process and have the Supreme Court declare it unconstitutional. The problem is that the process, I think, is too slow. And you cannot get a high-speed resolution to that question. So what they've actually done is they've passed two laws, separate numbers, with the same wording, or essentially the same wording. So when one gets bombed out by the Supreme Court, then they switch over to the other one and continue to enforce it until it gets declared unconstitutional. but they don't enforce the other one until the first one gets trashed. See? They plan ahead when they do their misbehavior.
If we know that there's two,
well, sometimes
can we go after both at the same time?
Well, the problem is knowing what laws they've passed. I mean, there's so many, you know, and when they do pass a law, they hide it. Like, for instance, Obamacare. You've all heard of that, right? Well, did you know that there's provisions in there for gun control? Okay. I mean, who would know that unless they read the entire thing? And if you were tuned into the literature, I don't think there's hardly anyone that knows that exists. And there's other provisions in that. They just attached all kinds of things to Obamacare. All right? Yes. Say that. I'm sorry. Repeat that, please.
He may not use a death benefit unless he's been receiving it for 3 years.
Yes, but you preceded. Yes, but you preceded that with something. You said there was a what?
Well, there's a one-line statement in the middle of the Obama loan. It says that you may not use a death benefit, like if someone dies, unless you've been receiving it for 3 years.
Oh, okay. So
that means that you can't use it as income. So you could have $10,000 a month sitting in the bank, and you can't use it as income.
Okay. Well, there's all sorts of tricky provisions. Yes. So anyway. Well, this kind of, unless you got some questions, this kind of is my presentation. You've got the discs. It's easy reading, believe me, you know, in comparison to most legal help. I think you'll benefit from this. And also, don't forget to read the other articles that are on the website, or on the disc. So.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank
you.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, you have a question.
License issue when you got married.
That's private. I'm not going to get into that subject.
I want to thank Bill for his presentation tonight. How many of you enjoyed what he had to say? Let's give him a big hand. This is what we like to have for our programs, and this is the kind of programs that I'm going to be promoting for as long as I'm around to do it. So anyway, I want to thank you all for here. I love this beautiful big crowd of people. I want to thank you all for being here, and pass this word along to them. The people, our programs are going to be here that you will enjoy, have interest. And we look forward to seeing you here again, possibly next month, but if not, I'll be giving you notice on that. But definitely in February, as I indicated, we're going to be doing a special program on Operation Terror, the film that was produced by Art Olivier, who was, by the way, also Mayor of Bellflower for a period of time. So thank you again for being here, and we're officially adjourned. You can get your copy of this and about 10 minutes and then or $10 a piece, I believe. So again, thank you.